It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, a conversation with Calvin Butler, the CEO of Exelon Utilities. He's also the chair of the board of directors of the Greater Baltimore Committee. We'll talk about efforts to make businesses in Baltimore more diverse, equitable, and inclusive, and we'll discuss the security of our energy resources. Are problems like what occurred in Texas last winter or cyber hacks that interrupted the Colonial Pipeline oil and gas supplies going to become more commonplace? You know, is our electric grid safe? We'll talk to Calvin Butler about all that tomorrow here on Midday. Joining me now is Dr. Gigi Granvall. She's an immunologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, who's been studying and writing about a number of issues related to the COVID-19 pandemic for these last many months. Dr. Granvall joins us from her home in Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
It's great to have you. So, the state issued numbers this morning that, again, are very encouraging. We have the second lowest level of people occupying intensive care unit beds. We've got a positivity rate in 18 of the jurisdictions in the state that's under 2%. 71% of adults in Maryland have received at least one dose of the vaccine. From your vantage point at the Center for Health Security, is this thing over? Is this thing on the way out the door? How would you place us in the arc of this pandemic?
Well, as we've learned very clearly over the last several months, infectious diseases don't know borders. And while Maryland is doing great and people are doing great, we still have issues where we need greater access to vaccine, and we need to worry about, the rest of the world.
Yeah, the rest of the world. And it's a big world out there to worry about, that's for sure. So if COVID remains and if infection rates remain high anywhere on the planet, we really can't consider this pandemic to be in the rearview mirror, can we?
No, we can't. And this is important for people to remember, not just for when we have discussions over whether we should share the vaccines that we've developed or whether we need to be doing more to help people around the world because to get other countries back on track. But it's also important selfishly for us, because every time that the virus infects somebody, we have a potential opportunity for different variants to emerge, and we want to make sure that we don't have problems in the future. So we have these amazing vaccines, and we want to make sure that they stay effective.
Dr. Gigi Granvall is an immunologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. If you'd like to join our conversation with Dr. Granvall, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. So, Dr. Granvall, in terms of what we have learned so far about this pandemic, are there things that we've learned that are going to be helpful the next time we have a pandemic? Because unfortunately, it is impossible to think that this is the last pandemic. But generally speaking, what knowledge have we gained because of SARS-CoV-2 that we didn't know before when we were handling other epidemics or pandemics, Ebola or H1N1, et cetera?
Wow, there's a lot there. There's a lot of things that we've learned scientifically about this virus that because science is incremental, we will be able to apply to future viruses that may emerge. There's a lot that we have learned about vaccines. We are very fortunate that, there's nothing fortunate about COVID, but just as far as where we are in our scientific development, that we were able to create a vaccine in such a short amount of time. And so lessons there will be for other vaccine, for other emerging pandemics. We want to make sure that we're able to get a vaccine out the door as quickly as possible, if it's possible. And of course, we've learned a lot about public health and how diseases are managed. And most of those lessons are bad. And those are going to take it's going to take some time to figure out what we do about it. But leadership matters, communication matters, and trust matters when it comes to public health.
And one of the things we evidently haven't quite learned is where this particular virus originated. What's your take on the conversation that's currently taking place in the public square about the so-called lab leak theory, saying that there are those who believe that this virus began in this lab in Wuhan, and it was not transmitted from animals, bats in particular, to human beings. So there seems to be a renewed controversy about that. How should we frame our understanding of that controversy, and what's your take?
Sure. So I think we need to be, we're just going to have a lot more uncertainty, be comfortable with uncertainty for some time while we're pursuing the origin of this virus. So it's a really important question to figure out where this virus came from, because we want to make sure that we do what we can to prevent viruses like it from becoming problems in the future. But a lot of the reasons that people thought originally that the virus came from the natural world is because that's where viruses come from. Three quarters of viruses that become epidemics have their roots in some other animal, and it's jumped species into humans, either directly or with a few species in between. And so a lot of people thought that SARS-CoV-2, just like SARS, just like other diseases like MERS, that this took a similar path. Recently, people have questioned whether or not a laboratory that has studied viruses had something to do with it. And I think there's so many different things that people are putting onto the different theories that I just want to tease out a little bit for your listeners that, you know, a lot of people think that it could have been created in a laboratory, and I want to urge people to, you know, science is amazing, but it's just not that amazing. We don't have the tools to be able to create a virus that has so many different features like this from scratch. And a lot of people are saying, well, you know, there was some sort of this term gain of function research. Again, that's putting a lot of faith in scientists to be able to manipulate the natural world that they don't quite have yet. But it is possible that a virus was isolated from the natural world and had some sort of laboratory involved, like in its release, that it may have infected people. And that's a different kind of investigation. It's possible we may never really know to the certainty that people want about that. But, you know, in the meantime, there's a lot that science can teach us about where the virus may have come, what viruses are like it that are in the natural world, and we're not doing enough to try and find them.
Is there a way of comparing the virus that's infecting people with this virus that may have come from the lab? Do people have samples of the virus that they're alleging came from this lab? Is it a testable thing? I mean, we've got the extra added dilemma of the reluctance of the Chinese government to cooperate in this kind of investigation. In a perfect world, if we had a sample of the virus that came from the lab and a sample that came from, you know, a virus that had infected somebody in the post, you know, outside the lab world, would they be different? Would we be able to tell the difference between the two of them?
Yeah. So the whole approach should be to try and find a virus that's as close to the one that has caused a pandemic as possible, to see, you know, what its relatives are. The closest relative that we know of is a virus called RATG613, and that virus sample was found in the natural world and was studied by the laboratory that is at the source of this controversy. But it's about 96 and a little bit percent identical to the virus that's caused that is SARS-CoV-2. And that sounds like, you know, a really close 96.3, I think it is. But because the virus is pretty big for a virus, that 3.7% is actually quite a big difference as far as the nucleotides go, and there's a it's actually quite a big leap from the virus that we know of and what we have spreading around the world. So 96.3 sounds like a solid A, but it actually is, you know, there's a 3.7% is a big difference.
Yeah, of course. Dr. Gigi Granvall is with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. It's midday. Excuse me. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @midday_WIPR. And to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. So the evidence for the lab leak theory versus the data and the evidence for the origin of the virus having to do with animals, with bats. Are they kind of even, Stephen? I mean, when you look at the data on both sides of this controversy, we have the Wall Street Journal reporting a few weeks ago that there were scientists in the lab in Wuhan who evidently came down with something that was similar to COVID, in November or December of 2019, prior to the epidemic and then pandemics, you know, prevalence in the world. When you look at what people are saying as a piece of data, as that particular piece of data, is it, in your view, you know, balanced, that there's a lot to be said for one theory and a lot to be said for the other, or is it proportionally very different from one side to the other?
I think it's proportionally pretty different. So the Chinese have said that the people who worked in that laboratory were tested to see if they had ever been exposed to COVID before, and they hadn't. You know, you could take that with however many grains of salt as you want, but I mean that's what we know. As far as the coming from the natural world, there are lots of different places that a virus could emerge. People think, well, it's a big city, you know, where Wuhan is a big city. It's 11 million people, and not a lot of caves with bats in it. But in fact, it was the site of a lot of wildlife that were sold in the markets, and it's kind of amazing to think about. But I mean, the wildlife trade and the animal trade in China is a $70 billion industry. It's bigger than our beef industry. And there's even though the World Health Organization was told that there was not a problem with illegal wildlife farming, outside experts have said that that's maybe a $20 billion industry. So there's lots of animals from all over being kept in poor conditions in some of these markets. But then the markets were shut down after the cases started spreading. So with that shutdown and the clean out, opportunities to take quite as many samples as we would have liked to be able to find the source of this virus are gone, and it becomes harder all the time to get the access to those samples.
Wow, that's amazing. $70 billion industry, bigger than the beef industry here in America. That's really quite something. Part of the challenge that you and the folks in your profession face, it seems to me, is that so much of this conversation about these various aspects related to COVID-19 happens in non-scientific venues and non-scientific forums. This is not just a matter of smart folks like you reading peer-reviewed articles and making a determination, yes, this holds up to scientific scrutiny, or no, it does not. I mean, we've got people appearing on Fox News and CNN and MSNBC and the major networks talking about this and their own opinions about what's going on. There's evidently a particular scientist from China who is pushing the theory that you mentioned earlier, that this was actually bioengineered and released deliberately by the Chinese government. And this person evidently appeared on Tucker Carlson on Fox News. And how do you respond to something like that? How do you keep the scientific record credible and something that you in the scientific community can trust, and then later on the rest of us can trust?
It's a really big problem, and I think it's going to be something that the scientific community is going to have to deal with for years to come, because that case that you mentioned, that scientist who has the credentials to speak about science, produce this report, that, you know, if you were experienced in the scientific literature around that issue, you would read it and say, this doesn't sound right. This sounds like she's cherry picking data. That's a pretty big leap, and whoa, that's totally not right at all. And so, but if you're not, it sounds sort of sciencey and sort of correct. And so that particular researcher, we took the trouble of writing a rebuttal to her bioengineered theory and went through it point by point to try and say, you know, that science is incorrect, that science, you're cherry-picking data, et cetera. And, we got some mentions of our rebuttal, our peer review of her report mentioned in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, et cetera. But I mean, you know, her report was downloaded a gazillion times, and so did we really counter the claims that she was making? Probably not. So it's something that we're just going to have to deal with, because it's hard for scientists to take on some of these actors who are deliberately misrepresenting the science, and it takes time, and it's not something that, you know, you're rewarded for either professionally or personally, because some of the people who are pushing these theories will then follow you on Twitter and make your life difficult. So it's not, it's an ongoing thing that we're going to need to deal with. Some people have stepped forward, like to try and counter some of the anti-vaccination movement people. It's hard. It's hard to do, and it takes a lot of personal toll.
Yeah, so many different dimensions to this, and I'm certainly grateful to you for adding to my lexicon of technical terms, and that things can sound sciencey. That's good. I'm glad to hear that, Dr. Granville, because I got to tell you, my own personal understanding of science, I mean, I am to understanding science what Kanye West is to subtlety. I really, it's a difficult thing for me to do. So it's really important to have you on the air. We're going to come back with you after a quick break. Dr. Gigi Granville, she's an immunologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and we will have more on the other side of a quick break. Our number here, if you have a question or a comment for Dr. Granville, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @midday WIPR. And before we go to our break, each week here on the program, it is our practice to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 143 people have been victims of homicide in Baltimore City. 14 people lost their lives to homicide last week. Authorities have released the identities of 11 of those victims. They are Sincere Johnson, age 21, Clinton Gray, age 46, Eric Wilson, age 41, Dana Ross, age 39, Julius Dunbar III, age 22. Toron Jackson, age 26. Isaiah Willis, age 20. Kenneth McCoy, age 62. Jamio McLean, age 33. Stephen Boyer, age 30. And Kiana Britton. She was 27 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Last Friday, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC, released a study showing a disturbing uptick in severe illness from COVID-19 among teenagers. The Pfizer vaccine has been approved for children age 12 and up. Moderna vaccine has been authorized for teens beginning at age 16. Dr. Walensky reminded everyone about what health officials have been saying for many months now. Vaccines are our way out of this pandemic. If you've just joined us today, my guest is an immunologist who has been working on issues related to the coronavirus since the outbreak of the pandemic. Dr. Gigi Granvall is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. To join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @midday WYPR. So, Dr. Granvall, the importance of everybody getting vaccines can't be understated and or overstated, and this includes children. What do we know about kids under the age of 16, kids under the age of 18 so far? What is the data telling us about safety, about side effects, and what's your advice to parents who've got kids in the teen and preteen years about getting vaccines?
Yes, I'm excited to talk about this because I really urge parents to get their kids vaccinated if they're of age to do so. And you can get vaccinated if you're 12 and up. And the Pfizer vaccine is approved for that or has emergency use authorization for that age group. And it probably will be pretty soon and to have the Moderna vaccine for that age group as well. We rightly think of COVID as a disease that has really afflicted older adults in particular a lot more than kids. The numbers speak for themselves. The mortality has been extreme, and it's definitely something that, that we're thankfully turning the corner on when it comes to vaccinating older adults and adults of all adults. But if there were no consideration, if we just didn't even know about all of those adults that suffer from COVID and all the problems that we have, we would be looking at COVID as a real problem for kids. Looking at the data, even though it is not something that kids do not suffer the same consequences as adults, it would be a top 10 killer for kids if we go by 2019 data. And it causes a lot of hospitalizations and a lot of lingering problems that we don't fully understand yet. And so when you have all that potential risk and you have this extremely safe vaccine, it's really, I just urge people to take the vaccine, get the vaccine for their kids as well. As soon as it was possible for me to vaccinate my 13-year-old, I took him at 8 a.m. at M&T Bank Stadium to the MassVax site, and he got his first dose. And I was so relieved, and I cannot wait to bring my 11-year-old, hopefully in August, September, when the FDA gives emergency use authorization for that under 12 group. But I can't wait to be able to vaccinate the whole family.
So your expectation is August, September is the general time frame for kids under 12 to be able to get vaccinated?
I think so. We'll see. They've said September, but you know they have been conservative, and the cases are high enough in the places where they're testing the vaccine that they should be able to meet their numbers. So I'm hopeful that'll be August or September that we'll get the authorization for the under 12s.
Dr. Gigi Granvall is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Let's go to the phones to Mary, who's on the line from Baltimore. Mary, welcome to the program with Dr. Granvall.
Hi, nice to be here. I have a comment and I have a question. My comment is, when you were asking what we learned from this, what lessons we learned, I would think mask wearing, the importance of it, and the fact that it works would be the biggest one for me. If we had stuck with it a little longer until the vaccines kicked in, I think we would have not lost quite as many people. And my other question was about vaccine tourism and how it might affect the spread of variants coming into the country.
I'm not sure I understand what Mary means by vaccine tourism, but Dr. Granvall, is that a term you've heard?
Sure. Yeah. So right now we have vaccine available in the U.S. in many different places, and you can walk in and for free you can get a vaccine. This is just not the case in a lot of the world, and they are still going through. If vaccine is available, they're not able to vaccinate everyone who wants it. You have to wait. And so the whole idea, just like medical tourism, where people go to different countries to get procedures done, vaccine tourism has become a term to describe people coming to the U.S. and getting their vaccine. I'm not as concerned about this when it comes to the variants. So far, the vaccines have been extraordinarily resilient against the variants if you've gotten both doses. I think we just need to think about, you know, making sure that the world gets access to this vaccine. And so it's unfortunate that we are not doing that in a more efficient way than having people come here to get the vaccine. We should be doing more to get populations around the world vaccinated. Regarding mask wearing, that brings up a really good point. Air quality is really important, and it's really important for not only for this disease, but for others like flu. And so I hope that masks and attention to air quality will be something that we take with us into the future, because this is not going to be the last disease that we're going to face.
And speaking of that, you all at the Health Security Center at Hopkins have recently published a report about the importance of ventilation in schools and the healthy air in schools and how important that is with or without COVID. What did you find?
Yeah, so one of the things I learned in doing that report was that air quality was something that was pretty terrible and a longstanding problem in schools and across the U.S., K through 12, and that it has a detrimental, if you have unhealthy air, it has a demonstrable effect on student learning and on their test scores. So it has consequences. It's not just that, you know, it's stuffy and kids can deal with it. It actually has problems for their learning. And then you throw a disease into the mix, and you've got a problem there. So COVID is transmitted through the air, as are some other diseases like flu. And so being able to purify the air, we recommended that schools have portable HEPA filtered units to put in so that they can clean the air and so that kids can have reduced risks of COVID and other diseases.
And that's going to help them just in general. I mean, it's going to help them against COVID, but it's going to just help them. It's going to make an environment in the air that is just simply more conducive to learning all the time, right?
Yeah, it's really a no-regret investment. We also recommended that a task force be created to create standards, not only for what the air should be in schools, but that commissioning standards to make sure that mechanical ventilation systems are maintained correctly and that they are tested every so often. We need to raise the bar a little bit when it comes to healthy air in schools. It's pretty disgraceful that that it's even an issue and a longstanding one at that.
Just got a couple of minutes left. You've written an article about the potential for bioterrorism and how our experience with COVID is informing that. I mean, I suppose it is, as you've said in this article, possible that bad actors could look at the United States and how we responded to COVID and say, you know, there's some vulnerabilities here. We could use bioterrorism to attack. Where does that stand in your estimation in terms of our leadership and our government's capacity to respond?
So biosecurity and preparing our defenses against bioterrorism has been it's a long-standing thing, and we have treaties with nations to we've all agreed that we are not going to use biology as a weapon, and that that treaty actually was signed in 1972, so it's coming up on its 50th year next year, but. You know, that doesn't apply to non-state actors, and it doesn't apply to countries that think that it doesn't apply to them. And there have been incidents over the years where some countries, Soviet Union, then Russia, Iraq, of course, South Africa, have used biology to as a weapon for offensive purposes that were illegal. But what I was looking at was mostly on non-state actors. I don't know if you recall early on in the pandemic, but the USS Theodore Roosevelt there were cases, they had trouble containing SARS-CoV-2 on the ship. And this symbol of American power in the world was reduced basically to a hospital. And so I think other nations, what I wrote about in that article, other nations would look at that and say, "Weesh, you know, I have a Navy, our country has a Navy, this could happen to us," and be more concerned for themselves. I worry that non-state actors would look at that same situation and say, "Huh, you know, this is an opportunity that we have to be able to take on a great power." And so I do worry about what the future may hold when it comes to biosecurity, and I hope that those fears are unfounded, but we do need to prepare.
Well, I know that our future holds having you on again to talk more about that, because I do think it's a really, really important and complicated issue, and you understand all of these issues so beautifully. So thank you so much for your time and expertise today, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Gigi Gronval, she's a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Calvin Butler, the CEO of Exelon Utilities and the chair of the Greater Baltimore Committee. We'll talk about how to make the local business environment more diverse, equitable, and inclusive, and we'll discuss how companies like his are keeping the electrical grid secure. So Calvin Butler joins me tomorrow on Midday. Stay tuned now for Here and Now. That's on the way after news at the top of the hour. Don't forget to download the Daily Dose, WYPR's compendium of local stories and COVID-19 response. As well, check out the Chesapeake Connect podcast. I host that one. We talk about regionalism. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great day.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.